Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Radio.
That's Red Priest's bouncy rendition of our theme tune, Vivaldi's Winter Largo, signalling that it's time for the latest episode of Evening Under Lamplight with your host, Robert Louis Abrahamson, here on Cambridge 105 Radio. We're now embarked on episode 2 of series 6 of Evening Under Lamplight, and I remarked last time that this series would try to bring to life for you various incidents in the great Greek and Latin epics involving Achilles, Odysseus, Penelope, Aeneas, and all the rest of them. A lofty ambition, and already in this second episode, I'm going to swerve from those plans. Well, look, to be frank, things have been much too hectic the past few weeks for me to have the time to prepare all the work it would have taken to discuss Aeneas's tale of the night the Greeks broke into Troy and destroyed the city. No, I'll let that story wait till next time. But this evening, Under Lamplight, we'll pick up an older episode from 2011 on the story of Cinderella. I'll just replay much of that older show, adding my own 2018 comments here and there. So that's what I'll be attending to, and of course you are invited to attend too. The episode is called Being Cinderella. You know the story of Cinderella, but we'll go further into the story than you're probably used to. Fairy tales are wise tales, and if we attend to them carefully and openly, we find all sorts of wisdom waiting for us. And so let's see what we can find in some of the incidents in some of the versions of the Cinderella story. There are over 900 versions of the tale all over the world. Well, these are all versions of the story in that they contain motifs about identifying one's true love because she fits a shoe or a ring or some other item that picks her out from the crowd. We'll not look at all 900, if you don't mind, but only a few. So I'll shift now to the voice of RLA from 7 years ago. Better studio quality than I can manage at the moment from where I am.
Let's get into the mood with a sentimental song from Tammy Wynette, a favorite of mine, but I've never had occasion to play any of her songs here on the show. But who could resist I Still Believe in Fairy Tales? It's a terribly maudlin song, and I'd hate to meet a person who really believed in fairy tales the way this woman does. But Tammy's voice is so wonderful, witty and vulnerable at the same time, every vowel turned into a diphthong. In the song, this woman depicts her life as a fairy tale. She's the princess and marries her knight in shining armor, who gives her a castle and a princess, and she was the world's proudest queen. But then along came a dragon in a bottle who slowly slayed the king. and they all lived happily never after, for we just put the castle up for sale. So it's not a fairy tale ending, but she insists that she still believes in fairy tales. I'm not sure why. Perhaps because they are an alternative to an honest look at her own dire life. But here's the song. Yes, we can laugh at it, or we can also feel pathos in its way.
I believe in fairy tales, where knights in shining armor come along. And I was the world's proudest queen. And then came the dragon in the bottle, and I watched as it slowly slayed the king.
One of the chief characteristics of a fairy tale, not found in Tammy Wynette's song, is the transformation of the hero or the heroine, a transformation that is often symbolized by the marriage, the change from the incomplete, questing, yearning individual into a united self, male and female, yin and yang in harmony. Oh yes, sure, you say. What, you don't believe in transformation? Well, you're not alone, and probably then you see fairy tales as delusion, or else some anthropological oddity useful for study, or to amuse kids, or what's worse, to inflict moral values upon children. But you don't see them as having any relevance to yourself. Elizabeth Lesser points out that myths and fairy tales do not set out rules, but rather serve as mirrors, pointing out what's going on in our lives already. To read an ancient story, she says, is like reading a letter from God, or at least from a wise old woman or man who took the trouble to record his trials, tests, and passages. And while the mail may not be addressed to you or me personally, it is the very universality of the messages that makes myths so powerful and ultimately helpful. The point of any myth or fairy tale is not to isolate a few figures as unique heroes and heroines, but rather to map the path of the hero's journey for you and me. Not all fairy tale maps show us a direction towards the transformative, however. Here's one that shows a progression from maiden to crone, her prince not a savior, but a man who brings her care and woe, a mysterious and empty piper, who seems to offer the power upon the hour, the ability to act effectively in her life, yet she squanders this power through inaction, as the story suggests we all do most of the time. The princess finally awakes to see her wasted life, a midlife crisis. What can she do but pass this knowledge or this curse we all share on to the next generation? The Song of the Morrow is not an easy tale, but its texture is exquisite, and I think it's the finest of all Robert Louis Stevenson's fables. You've heard it once before on Evening Under Lamplight, but we could attend to it every week and still find new things to see in it.
The Song of the Morrow. The King of Duntrine had a daughter when he was old, and she was the fairest king's daughter between two seas. Her hair was like spun gold, and her eyes like pools in a river. And the king gave her a castle upon the sea beach, with a terrace and a court of the hewn stone, and four towers at the four corners. Here she dwelt and grew up, and had no care for the morrow, and no power upon the hour, after the manner of simple men. It befell that she walked one day by the beach of the sea, when it was autumn, and the wind blew from the place of rains, and upon the one hand of her the sea beat, and upon the other the dead leaves ran. This was the loneliest beach between two seas, and strange things had been done there in the ancient days. Now the king's daughter was aware of a crone that sat upon the beach. The sea foam ran to her feet, and the dead leaves swarmed about her back, and the rags blew about her face in the blowing of the wind. Now, said the king's daughter, and she named a holy name, this is the most unhappy old crone between two seas. Daughter of a king, said the crone, you dwell in a stone house, and your hair is like the gold. But what is your profit? Life is not long, nor lives strong, and you live after the way of simple men, and have no thought for the morrow, and no power upon the hour. Thought for the morrow, that I have, said the king's daughter, but power upon the hour, that have I not. And she mused with herself. Then the crone smote her lean hands one within the other, and laughed like a seagull. Home, cried she, O daughter of a king, home to your stone house, for the longing is come upon you now, nor can you live any more after the manner of simple men. Home, and toil and suffer, till the gift come that will make you bear, and till the man come that will bring you care. The king's daughter made no more ado, but she turned about and went home to her house in silence. And when she was come into her chamber, she called for her nurse. Nurse, said the king's daughter, thought is come upon me for the morrow, so that I can live no more after the manner of simple men. Tell me what I must do, that I may have power upon the hour. And the nurse moaned like a snow wind. Alas, said she, that this thing should be, but the thought is gone into your marrow, nor is there any cure against the thought. Be it so, then, even as you will. Though power is less than weakness, power shall you have. And though the thought is colder than winter, yet shall you think it to an end. So the king's daughter sat in her vaulted chamber in the masoned house, and she thought upon the thought. 9 years she sat, and the sea beat upon the terrace, and the gulls cried about the turrets, and wind crooned in the chimneys of the house. 9 years she came not abroad, nor tasted the clean air, neither saw God's sky. 9 years she sat and looked neither to the right nor to the left, nor heard speech of any one, but thought upon the thought of the morrow. And her nurse fed her in silence, and she took of the food with her left hand and ate it without grace. Now when the 9 years were out, it fell dusk in the autumn, and there came a sound in the wind like a sound of piping. At that the nurse lifted up her finger in the vaulted house. "I hear a sound in the wind," said she, "that is like the sound of piping." "It is but a little sound," said the king's daughter, "but yet it is sound enough for me." So they went down into the dusk to the doors of the house, and along the beach of the sea. And the waves beat upon the one hand, and upon the other the dead leaves ran, and the clouds raced in the sky, and the gulls flew widdershins. And when they came to that part of the beach where strange things had been done in the ancient ages, lo, there was the crone, and she was dancing widdershins. "What makes you dance widdershins, old crone?" said the king's daughter, "here upon the bleak beach between the waves and the dead leaves." "I hear a sound in the wind that is like the sound of piping," quoth she, "and it is for that that I dance widdershins. For the gift comes that will make you bare, and the man comes that must bring you care. But for me the morrow is come that I have thought upon, and the hour of my power." "How comes it, crone," said the king's daughter, "that you waver like a rag and pale like a dead leaf before my eyes?" "Because the morrow has come that I have thought upon, and the hour of my power," said the crone. And she fell on the beach, and lo, she was but stalks of the sea tangle, and dust of the sea sand, and the sand lies hopped upon the place of her. "This is the strangest thing that befell between two seas," said the king's daughter of Duntrine. But the nurse broke out and moaned like an autumn gale. "I am weary of the wind," quoth she, and she bewailed her day. The king's daughter was aware of a man upon the beach. He went hooded, so that none might perceive his face, and a pipe was underneath his arm. The sound of his pipe was like singing wasps, and like the wind that sings in windlestraw, and it took hold upon men's ears like the crying of gulls. "Are you the comer?" quoth the king's daughter of Duntrine. "I am the comer," said he, "and these are the pipes that a man may hear, and I have power upon the hour, and this is the song of the morrow." And he piped the song of the morrow, and it was as long as years, and the nurse wept out aloud at the hearing of it. "This is true," said the king's daughter, "that you pipe the song of the morrow. But that ye have power upon the hour, how may I know that? Show me a marvel here upon the beach, between the waves and the dead leaves." And the man said, "Upon whom?" "Here is my nurse," quoth the king's daughter. "She is weary of the wind. Show me a good marvel upon her." Lo, the nurse fell upon the beach as it were two handfuls of dead leaves, and the wind whirled them widdershins, and the sand lice hopped between. "It is true," said the king's daughter of Duntrine, "you are the comer, and you have power upon the hour. Come with me to my stone house." So they went by the sea margin, and the man piped the song of the morrow, and the sea leaves followed behind them as they went. Then they sat down together, and the sea beat on the terrace, and the gulls cried about the towers, and the wind crooned in the chimneys of the house. 9 years they sat, and every year when it fell autumn, the man said, "This is the hour, and I have power in it." And the daughter of the king said, "Nay, but pipe me the song of the morrow." And he piped it, and it was long like years. Now when the 9 years were gone, the king's daughter of Duntrine got her to her feet, like one that remembers, and she looked about her in the masoned house, and all her servants were gone. Only the man that piped sat upon the terrace, with the hand upon his face, and as he piped, the leaves ran about the terrace, and the sea beat along the wall. Then she cried to him with a great voice, "This is the hour, and let me see the power in it." And with that the wind blew off the hood from the man's face, and lo, there was no man there, only the clothes and the hood and the pipes tumbled one upon another in a corner of the terrace, and the dead leaves ran over them. And the king's daughter of Duntrine got her to that part of the beach where strange things had been done in the ancient ages. And there she sat her down. The sea foam ran to her feet, and the dead leaves swarmed about her back, and the veil blew about her face in the blowing of the wind. And when she lifted up her eyes, there was the daughter of a king come walking on the beach. Her hair was like the spun gold, and her eyes like pools in a river, and she had no thought for the morrow, and no power upon the hour, after the manner of simple men.
I thought, since the king's daughter of Duntrine returned to the beach of the sea, and the whole scene returned, only with her as the crone and another young woman as the princess with her hair like spun gold, that it would be appropriate to follow Stevenson's Song of the Morrow with The Return by Catherine Tickle. She's playing the Northumbrian pipes, but I don't see why that should matter, as long as the pipes sing like wasps. Okay, let's move on to Cinderella, our promised story, a true fairy tale, if by true we mean one with a happy ending, the heroine winning her prince. One feature in this story, which is found in many of the Cinderella versions, is the absence of the mother. The heroine is left without a nurturing mother in a kind of abandoned state. In the versions most people in the West know, the mother is replaced by a stepmother, a wicked stepmother. She's a stepmother as a symbol that she does not fulfill the true mother's role of nurturing her daughter. And yet, in a sense, she does the biggest favor she could for the girl. She impels the girl to fend for herself. And this, in its way, is the best, but hardest, nurturing. The father in these tales is often absent, away on a journey or simply busy with his own self-contained concerns, like Mr. Bennet in Pride and Prejudice, which is, after all, another version of Cinderella. In Perrault's version of Cinderella, the girl feels it's no good complaining to her father since he would have rattled her off, for his wife governed him entirely. In the story Donkey Skin, another Cinderella type retold by Charles Perrault, after the queen dies, the king is smitten with an uncontrollable passion to marry his daughter, who, the story says, even possessed certain charms that his dead wife never had. Whatever that might be. In the Grimm version of the story, the father goes on a journey, and as in Beauty and the Beast, he asks his daughters what he can bring back for them. The other girls ask for beautiful clothes and jewelry, but Cinderella asks for a hazel branch. It's not clear how she knows about hazel, but it is a sacred tree connected with magic and the world of the dead. In fact, Cinderella plants the branch in the ground at her mother's grave and waters it with her copious tears, and soon the branch grows into a tree which connects her to her dead mother and has the power to grant her wishes. It's thus a kind of mother figure for the girl. But in many ways, more important than the father and the stepmother are the stepsisters. The Grimm version shows us just how nasty they are to our heroine. "Is the stupid goose to sit in the parlor with us?" one of the stepsisters asks. Sisterhood is malfunctioning for Cinderella. Instead of a support group, her sisters put her down and leave her on her own. Perhaps that's not such a bad idea, though, since ultimately we each have to move deeper than our support group. Later in the story, the stepsisters elbow to usurp Cinderella's place by the prince's side. They're trying to become Cinderella and thus reveal themselves as shadow selves of Cinderella, the parts of her that are to be rejected. False images of the girl. Perhaps it's best, then, that the sisters distance themselves from her. She needs to grow up away from the vain and trivial parts of herself that the sisters represent and go to the ball by an indirect, subtler way. But first, we must consider what's going on inside Cinderella, inside her head and heart. She's made to spend her days in the cinders, in the ashes. That is, in the kitchen, in the lowest position in the household, splattered by the cooking fat, scorched by the fire, soiled by the dust and ashes. She was told she was no good and that this is her place, and as far as we can tell, she believes it. That's the real psychological problem here, and it makes the story of Cinderella the story of anyone with low self-esteem. I belong in the ashes. I'm not good enough to sit in the parlor with the others. Such a voice will be sad, but it need not always be self-pitying. And it needs rescuing. Cinderella can be found as the adolescent who sits dreaming and turning bitter, like Gertie McDowell in Ulysses, as you'll recall, or the girl or boy, the fairy tale characters are not gender specific, the girl or boy will be the kind of person walking around with head bowed and shoulders rounded, maybe the kind of person who does things for everyone else and will not allow anyone to do anything for her or him. Or Cinderella can even turn into the tough exterior, the common defense for those who are particularly vulnerable. And that's what we find in our Kinks song, Heart of Gold. Growing up isn't easy to do, especially for one who always knew you would always come up second best. Is that why you have such bitterness? The apple of your father's eye, and always by your brother's side, then a little sister came along, and you found all the affection suddenly gone. But underneath the cold exterior, I know you've got a heart of gold, so aloof, so superior, but you've got a heart of gold.
Why you have such bitterness? The apple of your father's eye, and always by your brother's side. Then a little sister came along, and you found all the affection suddenly gone. But underneath the cold exterior, I know you got a heart of gold, so aloof and so superior, but you got a heart of gold.
Watch out!
Don't get caught in the crossfire.
Watch out!
Still growing up, she's in a rage. I guess she reached that difficult age. Growing up is very hard. Everybody watching your every move. Your private life always on view. But jealousy never really suited you. But I know that underneath the rude exterior, there's gotta be a heart of gold. Underneath that hard exterior is a little girl waiting to be told. A heart of gold. She's got a heart of gold. Must have been the one who always knew. You had a heart of gold.
Underneath the good exterior, you've got a heart of gold. So aloof, so superior, but you got a heart of gold. Underneath the good exterior, you've got a heart of gold. Underneath the hard exterior, you've got a heart of gold.
Watch out!
She'll give you a broadside, but on the inside,
she got a heart of gold.
underneath that rude exterior, you've got a heart of gold. Well, we knew that if we knew how to read the symbols. Yes, Cinderella is kept down in the kitchen, in the cinders and ashes, but think again. This is the hearth, the warm center of the household, the most nurturing place, after all. And under the ashes are the glowing cinders, just waiting for the right moment to burst back into flame. The right moment comes, as so often in myth and fairy tale, in the form of supernatural aid. In the Grimm story, it is the magic hazel tree, representing the mother, who gives Cinderella the chance to go to the dance. In the more popular Perrault version, it is the fairy godmother, a godmother, the supernatural aspect of maternity, who helps. We can't do it on our own. We need that help. But that help is only temporary. Cinderella must famously leave the party early. She cannot linger. It's as though she's just been given a glimpse of her possibilities, a glimpse of what it would feel like to have people actually admire her for her beauty. How else, after all, can Cinderella claim her beauty? She cannot become what she cannot imagine becoming. Or, since this is such an important truth, let's put it in another way. We cannot become what we cannot imagine becoming. We cannot accept that we are beautiful until we can picture our beauty manifested in the world. Hence the importance of good literature to instill all sorts of possibilities into our imagination. Fairy tales implant in our minds the image of the transformation and offer, for some of us, the only chance we have to move from the cinders to the ballroom floor. Maybe some people call fairy tales lies because they don't like to be reminded of these possibilities. And who is this prince, by the way? Well, yes, on one level there's a certain unpleasantness about his holding a ball so he can survey all the women in the kingdom to choose for his bride, a kind of meat market or beauty pageant. But maybe since his wife will be just for show, as he is just for show, then all that really matters is how well she carries herself at a ball. This is an important way to understand the story. On one level, the story begs for our cynicism. But there are other ways, too, which take us deeper. We all are looking for our prince, our princeps, our chief good, our match. If Cinderella is beauty, the beauty lying within each of us, then the prince is will or desire, or the talent and skill to make things happen. Beauty needs the energy of desire to become complete. So how do we get our prince? Disney would have it that we get the prince just by being good and complacent. The long-suffering, sweet little girl wins in the end. We don't believe that anymore, nor did the older versions of the tale. The Grimm version shows her determined and wily and taking the initiative, a trickster outsmarting the prince and luring him on. Another version, Stephen Sondheim's In the Woods, shows a much more modern Cinderella, fit for a New York setting, who is stuck in the glue the prince has placed on the palace steps to trap her before she can get away. This becomes an existentialist moment for her, a moment of awakening to possibilities as she reflects on what it means to be attractive. He's a very smart prince. He's a prince who prepares. Knowing this time I'd run from him, he spread pitch on the stairs. I was caught unawares, and I thought, well, he cares. This is more than just malice. Better stop and take stock while you're standing here stuck on the steps of the palace. And this existential moment requires a choice. But how can she choose? You think, what do you want? You think, make a decision. Why not stay and be caught? You think, well, it's a thought. What would be his response? And then the identity crisis, which inevitably follows. How can we choose unless we know who we are? But then what if he knew who you were when you know that you're not what he thinks that he wants? And then what if you are what a prince would envision? But how can she know who she is? How can she choose until she knows what she wants? She needs that prince as an expression of her own desires. Although how can you know who you are till you know what you want, which you don't? Here's the choice. Go back to where it is safe, the cinders, her old low self-esteem, her old self, although she is treated so badly there. Or move into this new world of the palace where she is treated right, but, well, it doesn't feel like her true self. She has never seen herself as belonging in a world where she's treated with kindness, let alone love. Surely she doesn't belong in such a place. So then which do you pick? Where you're safe out of sight and yourself, but where everything's wrong, or where everything's right and you know that you'll never belong? And whichever you pick, do it quick, because you're starting to stick to the steps of the palace. It's your first big decision. The choice isn't easy to make. To arrive at a ball is exciting and all. Once you're there, though, it's scary. And it's fun to deceive when you know you can leave. But you have to be wary. There's a lot that's at stake. But you've stalled long enough, because you're standing stuck in the stuff on the steps. So she chooses the path that will demand no choice of her. She leaves the choice to the prince, but first leaving him a clue, her shoe. Better run along home and avoid the collision. Even though they don't care, you'll be better off there where there's nothing to choose, so there's nothing to lose. So you pry up your shoes, then from out of the blue and without any guide, you know what your decision is, which is not to decide. You'll leave him a clue, for example, a shoe, and then see what he'll do. Now it's he and not you who is stuck with a shoe in a stew in the goo, and you've learned something too, something you never knew on the steps of the palace.
He's a very smart prince. He's a prince who prepares. Knowing this time I'd run from him, he spread pitch on the stairs. I was caught unawares, and I thought, well, he cares. This is more than just malice. Better stop and take stock while you're standing. You're stuck on the steps of the palace. You think, what do you want? You think, make a decision. Why not stay and be caught? You think, well, it's a thought, what would be his response? But then what if he knew who you were when you know that you're not what he thinks that he wants? And then what if you are what a prince would envision? Although how can you know who you are till you know what you want, which you don't? So then which do you pick? Where you're safe out of sight and yourself, but where everything's wrong? Or where everything's right and you know that you'll never be alone. And whichever you pick, do it quick, cause you're starting to stick to the steps of the palace. It's your first big decision. The choice isn't easy to make. To arrive at a ball is exciting and all. Once you're there, though, it's scary. And it's fun to deceive when you know you can leave, but you have to be wary. There's a lot that's at stake, but you've stalled long enough, cause you're still standing stuck in this stuff on the steps. Better run along home and avoid the collision. Even though they don't care, you'd be better off there where there's nothing to choose, so there's nothing to lose. So you pry up your shoes, then from out of the blue and without any guide, you know what your decision is, which is not to decide. You'll just leave him a clue, for example, a shoe, and then see what he'll do. Now it's he and not you who is stuck with a shoe in a stew in the goo. And you've learned something too.
And I've learned something too.
Something you never knew.
And I've learned something too
that I never knew before.
In the land of the giants.
That was Cinderella's Song on the Steps of the Palace from Into the Woods by James Lapine and Stephen Sondheim. I'm grateful to AB for pushing me to attend to this show and this song. Oh yes, and let's not forget about the shoe. Why a shoe, of all things? Well, just think of it. Your foot is, in a way, the mark of your identity, your footprint. Your gait, your means of moving, identifies you to other people. I remember in the mornings in school, walking through the corridors before classes started, when, for some reason, I would not put on my glasses until later in the day, yet I could always recognize my friends from a distance by the way they were walking. And there's one school of acting that holds that once the actor finds the right way for the character to walk, then the actor can fall easily into the part. This is a problem, though, for many modern actors who know of no way to walk except that sloppy modern slouch with bouncy trainers. They will never move right if they're playing any historical character. Okay, but a glass shoe? In Perrault's French version of the story, Cinderella is given shoes of verre, V-E-R-R-E, glass. But it's probable that in earlier versions the shoes were made of verre, V-A-I-R, which refers to a kind of delicate fur. This sounds much more plausible for elegant dancing slippers. If the glass slippers are a mistake, then it's one of those fortunate mistakes that improve rather than destroy. That's how these folk stories grow, by adaptation. Someone makes a mistake in the telling, but the mistake feels right, and some deeper wisdom keeps it in when the story is told again. A glass slipper seems a much richer image, first because it is so unusual, and thus fit for a fairy's present. But more than that, a glass shoe feels right because it is a shoe that reveals, not conceals. It's transparent. It's there, but we cannot see it on you. The whole story has been about an identity crisis, and so why not have a shoe that supports this theme? And let's also remember that a slipper is a shoe one can easily slip in and out of, just as Cinderella slips between different identities until she finally settles on her true identity as the fulfilled person. May we all do the same. Yes, of course, a pair of glass slippers are absurd to wear for dancing, but so would the Cinderella's gown of gold and jewels. We have to put aside these practical considerations when we're living in the symbolic other world of myth and fairy tales. In fact, the unreal elements are what give the story its magic feel. Ask any kid who's not jaded yet. In the Grimm version, the prince comes seeking the girl who fits the shoe. The two stepsisters try to claim the shoe, but their feet don't fit. The mother tells one daughter to cut off her big toe so she can fit the shoe. After all, when she becomes a princess, she'll never have to walk again. She does so. She fits the shoe, and the prince rides off with her. But the birds coming from the hazel tree alert him. Turn and peep, turn and peep. There's blood within the shoe. The shoe, it is too small for her. The true bride waits for you. The prince looks down, sees the blood, and brings the stepsister back. The other sister tries, has to cut off her heel so she can fit the shoe. And again the prince, he's not all that bright, we realize, rides off until the birds alert him again. Turn and peep, there's blood within the shoe. The shoe, it is too small for her, the true bride waits for you. So much for the false selves, twisting to fit a role they do not belong in. Finally, the prince insists that dirty old Cinderella try. I hope they've cleaned the blood off the shoe already. And to his delight, the stepmother and stepsister's chagrin, the foot fits and all is happy. but I like the Perrault version better at this point. Cinderella knows she has won the game. She suddenly feels her power in the midst of that house where she has always been put down. "Let me see if it will not fit me," she says playfully, almost casually. "Let me see if it will not fit me." It is her ability to speak in this way, rather than her fitting the shoe, that shows that she has truly been transformed, and not like the fairy godmother's temporary transformation. Now she is ready for the prince, and he for her. Happily ever after. A miracle? Sure, that's what it's all about. Yesterday I was one of the lonely people. Now you're lying close to me, giving it to me. You know the song? Attend to the wonderful Earl Brown's voice, so innocent and boyish in his delight in finally finding his princess.
Believe in miracles. Where you from?
Well, you didn't expect that song, did you? You Sexy Thing by Hot Chocolate. But I think that's just the right feel for this exciting climax of our fairy tale, the apotheosis, when the Ash Girl becomes sexy and the two become one in unity. And the father? He disappears from the story. Who needs him at this point? And the sisters? In Perrault and the sentimental versions coming from him, Cinderella forgives her sisters and finds them nice husbands from the court. But in the Grimm version, as they go into the church for the wedding, those magic birds reappear and pluck out one eye from each sister. And when they come out of the church afterwards, the birds come back and pluck out the other eye. And that's how the story ends. Those who were blind to beauty before are now blind to everything else. From her that hath not shall be taken away even that which she hath. Is this true also of how we read these fairy tales? If we are blind to their possibilities, then we become blind to all the beauties of the story, and it becomes nothing but a stupid tale of glass shoes, gold dresses, improbable talking birds, and pumpkin coaches. Tammy Wynette sings about that woman who still believes in fairy tales, even though her world is crumbling. That seems a little desperate and stupid. Stevenson's King's Daughter of Duntrine tries, I think, too hard to control her world, which leaves her unable to move towards any transformation other than into the lonely and too late wise crone. But let's end with something more uplifting and joyful, an assertion of the possibility of transformation coming along in a time of strife, when we're in the ashes or when eating with the pigs off a fancy tray. The more improbable the song seems, the more we have to stretch and only barely get it, the more true, it seems to me, the song is. See how it strikes you as we move out, you and me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, from this evening's Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Radio, as we move out with Bob Dylan's You Changed My Life, and see you next time. I was listening to the voices of death on parade. Get ready for the non-stop energy of celebration here.
I was listening to the voices of death on parade. Singing about conspiracy, wanted me to be afraid. Working for a system I couldn't understand. But you changed my life. Came along in a time of strife. It hungered me. You made my heart bleed. You changed my life. Talk about self.
joy.